Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Writing the Rapids, the show where I, Joe Bilecki, talk to writers about writing. Very often, those writers have been recommended to me by writers who have previously been on the show, or they've been on the show already, and it's a rejoinder episode. And that's what this is today. We are rejoined by David Leo Rice to talk about his new book, The Berlin Wall, out through Whiskey Tit Books. David Leo Rice is the author of several other novels, including The New House, Angel House, and The Dodge City Trilogy, as well as the story collection Drifter, which was named one of the 10 most read collections of 2021 in the Southwest Review. His next collection, The Squim Bop Condition, will be out in 2025. He's online at raviddice.com. Before we get into my conversation with David, however, let's ask you for money. Please consider giving me a little bit of money. For $2 a month, patreon.com/noisemakerjoe, you can get these episodes about a day earlier than everybody else, or you can buy my book. It's called Tired. It's on Amazon. Or you can not give me money, but support the show in more free ways, like posting about it on social media, telling your friends about it, rating it 5 stars wherever you listen to it, and listening to it all the way through. Now, without further ado, let's get into my conversation with David. Do you remember the SNL Weekend Update Bill Hader character, Stefan?
Yeah.
I felt like Stefan reading this book, because it's like, oh man, this book has everything. Esoteric Euro nationalism, time loops, road trips, mpreg, everything. And you know, I was trying to think, because it's, I feel like it's been a while since I've read a book of yours. But I feel like in the past we've talked an awful lot about America. And the Berlin Wall is a very European book. So I'm interested, I guess, kind of first and foremost, why the continental shift?
Yeah, partly just to seek out new ground, you know, literally and mentally, you know, and just to challenge myself to do something that would start out as different as possible, like in terms of the concept, and then work its way toward some continuity with my other work in terms of themes or in terms of types of things that happen. And I think there's kind of an interesting reciprocity in that I wrote, it didn't end up coming out first, but the first novel that I really wrote, you know, with the intention of really finishing it, Angel House, I wrote in Berlin. So I lived in Berlin for a year after college. And I wrote the first draft that year. So that was sort of the opposite state of mind, in that I was living in Germany, but like totally focused on not only on America, but on like the most local kind of American experience to my experience, like basically just my hometown, essentially. And so for this book, I wanted to do the opposite, that I wanted it to be, you know, having not been back to Berlin for a while, you know, I wrote this book basically all in New York. But fantasizing about the other side of that equation.
Okay, that's fun. Do you think... I'm trying to... Well, okay, so... I joked about it, but there is, you know, very obvious threads of nationalism... and like different kinds of nationalism, right? Like, I don't know, would you pronounce it Georgie or George?
Yeah, or Georgi, maybe.
Yeah, for how Hungarian my ancestry is, I don't speak nor can I pronounce Hungarian words. But, you know, he's like, he goes to Germany and kind of aligns himself with the nationalists there, and is simultaneously and more throughout the book pulled toward a sort of Hungarian nationalism, right? So the sort of standard pathway you might expect is somebody starting out in one place and moving to a different place ideologically, but he never really confronts his nationalistic tendencies aside from the locale that he's decided should be in charge.
Yeah. And maybe it, insofar as I wanted to empathize with him, as you have to write any character, I sort of wanted him to be drawn towards some mythic and fantastical idea of Hungary, but never be in Hungary, really. Mm-hmm. No scenes in the book are set in Hungary. The same way that I would also be a foreigner in Germany, you know, when I am in Germany, but also while writing the book, you know, so like whatever my ideas about like American nationalism could be are totally sublimated in the book because there is no America in the book, or at least it's not mentioned, you know? And I thought also just there was some kind of irony and maybe pathos in that character, in that the thing he's ostensibly fighting for, he keeps like getting further and further from, you know, and sort of wrapped up in somebody else's nationalistic fantasy, which actually ends up having a very lowly role in mind for him, right? He's certainly not the hero of their fantasy.
No. Yeah, and he keeps, well, everybody keeps going back to the same place. Like, there's lots of road trips, and everybody's pulled back to the same town in the Black Forest that's kind of outside of geography or under Europe or outside of Europe, or sort of like out of sync. I guess it kind of reminds me of the scenes near the end of Interstellar when he's like in the fifth dimension and he's seeing all of these intersecting pathways. And so there's like that sort of like space outside of time, which I really enjoyed that idea. I tend to have a desire in literature for space to make less sense. Not necessarily for any sort of like intellectual reason. I just like that idea of like walking through a door into a space that's completely different. And so like you just drive through a forest and you're in a town, and all of the things that are happening outside of the town are not as important, not having as big of an effect.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it, on the one hand, that's just truer to how spaces exist in your mind, right? So if you're sitting at your desk writing or sitting in a chair maybe reading, you're not in any of those spaces. So the connections between them are totally fluid. Like there isn't any real distance between, you know, Paris and London. You could just name those two things together on a page and they're next to each other.
Yeah.
Right. And like, you know, somewhere in your mind that they're not literally next to each other, but there's no, like, there's no rule in literature that real geography should be respected. And I agree with you that it's often more interesting when it's not. It seems like kind of a strange idea to work against the power of literature to change geography and try to, you know, preserve external geography. Seems, and maybe there are reasons to do that, but I agree that it's more interesting when you don't, or when you sort of mash up the space in a way that is more psychologically true and more game-like, right? I think that's something you get in Murakami a lot, like, you know, reading his books as a teenager. You know, there are plots, like they're not abstract exactly, but the thing that is so exciting about them, I think, is the feeling of potential, you know, especially within Tokyo and Japan, and like how he describes how physical reality could become a kind of liminal reality, you know, and people are always like going down wells or manholes and like popping up in other kinds of corridors. It has a bit of like a video game quality. But to me, as, you know, reading those books at a really formative age, like maybe 19 to 25 or something like that, it was really the use of space that I think impregnated itself and made me not even want to do that, but just have a sense that that is how space works in novels.
Mm. Yeah, and identity in the Berlin Wall works kind of similarly too, where people are, it's not quite Lynchian. There's not necessarily explicit doppelgangers, but particularly the chancellor and the mayor, just kind of like get recycled within themselves to the point where they don't really have an identity beyond that. And that's why I joked about time loops too. It's not, you know, this isn't Groundhog Day, but the 1980s or anything. It's, I mean, it takes place in 2020, but the shifting identities that like really kind of just melt around, I guess also kind of feels psychologically true as well. Where you're kind of one person around your group of friends, and then you come home with your partner and you're a little different, and then you're on your own and you can be all kinds of different versions of yourself. And then also game-like too, I suppose, right? You're respecking the character as needed.
Yeah, and they get sort of upgraded or sometimes downgraded, but it's like there's some external force, but that you can perceive as being present in the novel that is like swapping these characters in and out. And I think maybe it relates to their own feelings about themselves, that they always feel like they're not quite the real version, right? Or everyone has this sense of inauthenticity, not just in the way we tend to mean it as like not being cool or something, but like literally that they aren't the character they appear to be,
mm-hmm.
right? That they're sort of like slotted into the mold of that character, but in a way that doesn't fit and that's not going to last that long, you know? And maybe, you know, when you mentioned Groundhog Day, that is kind of an, I mean, I wasn't thinking about that film per se, but there is that sense of like Groundhog Day, but the 1980s, of like how, one theme of the book is sort of like, how is it that the 2020s doesn't feel more different from the 1980s? Like how is it that things don't seem like they've changed that much? You know, how is it something like the Berlin Wall is still like a resonant image, even though it's, you know, so long gone, you know what I mean? And maybe in a way, what the characters are seeking, like you said, that they're all being drawn to this town in the Black Forest, it's kind of like the belly button, it's like the center of the organism of Europe, right? You know, and it is kind of a geographical center. What they're seeking is a place beyond time, right? And it's what the nationalists kind of mean when they talk about Atlantis.
Mm-hmm.
They're seeking a place beyond time, but where that's a good thing, right? A place that's kind of proudly beyond time and that knows it's beyond time. It's kind of like a heaven on earth. But they're stuck in this kind of sludgy situation where it seems like time is like glitching and repeating and skipping ahead maybe, but like they're not free of time. And it's kind of like our world of like, we're endlessly arguing about, you know, has history ended? Has history restarted? What does it mean to be in history? Do we want to be back into history? Do we want to escape history? You know, and maybe that's the human condition, but like there's a yearning in everybody for, you know, some people might just call it heaven, but like for some world that you're not stuck in that kind of question of, are you keeping up with time or are you losing time? Like all those things drive us crazy. And when you feel like time's not moving at the right rate, that causes a lot of the maybe violent tendencies and repressive tendencies that seem to be happening, I mean, in the world, but also in the book. Mm-hmm. And the characters are yearning to break out of that, but I don't know if they ever can.
Yeah, I mean, it could very well just be the flux of existence, unfortunately. What's the Buddha say? Existence is suffering because we want things?
Sure, yeah, desire is pain. And maybe not unfortunately. I mean, maybe it's sort of like there's a spirit of fun in it too. Like in a way you could say there's, it cheapens things, or there's a kind of like degradation of morality if you see things as a game, right? Mm-hmm. Or you might tell your kids, you know, life's not a game or whatever. But also there's a sense of fun of like the point of games is to play them, not necessarily to win them or to overtake them, right? So there's a way of like maybe one human drive is to escape the flux, and another human drive, which I'm almost think is a better human drive, is to enjoy the flux once you accept that you can't escape it.
Yeah. And I mean, along with the Buddhism thing, that's like the point, right? Is to just be like, yep, things are going to change. We're going to ride it.
Right. Yeah, riding it is like a game too. It's like an amusement park, or, you know, it's like some mm-hmm. journey that you're on that's not totally in your control and may have like an unknown destiny, and on some level has a horrible destiny if you think of, you know, everyone's ultimate fate. But if you can enjoy that anyway, then you're in a good place.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And that's interesting to me. I've been thinking recently a lot about like the idea of gender performance, and the labeling of clothes as costume. And I don't know, this is connecting things in my brain that like, yeah, if when you're out in the world, if you're performing and if your clothes are costumes and that's all part of it, that, you know, maybe that Shakespeare fella had a point about all the world being a stage sort of thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And that certainly relates to the like fascistic tendencies in this book of, you know, I mean, I'm far from the first person to say this, but the idea that, you know, fascism is like squishing together the realms of morality and aesthetics, mm-hmm. right? That it's a sort of desire to make the world look a certain way. And it often is obsessed with costumes, right? And uniforms and a certain vision of what like the male body is supposed to look like and the female body is supposed to look like, that has an aesthetic dimension and wouldn't be so bad if it were just aesthetic, the way like, you know, someone like David Bowie or someone can just use that aesthetic and that's his own thing. But the way it becomes bad, of course, is when you start forcing people who don't want to be part of that aesthetic into the aesthetic. And, you know, then you, history is no shortage of examples of what happens next.
Yeah. Tangentially, or maybe left fieldly, was really, really fascinated by the Lars von Trier cameo in this book. He's an interesting figure because he said dumb things about right-wing people. I also haven't seen his older films. Like, everything I've seen is like Antichrist and more contemporary. So the idea that he's doing a performance art bit at some point to like try to get back to that was funny to me, because it's just like, oh, I associate him with the right because he said dumb things at Cannes.
Which is going on again right now.
It is. Yeah. Cannes is happening as we record. And I don't know what's going on there, but,
I remember once I told years and years ago, I told someone I had a kind of stress dream where somehow I was supposed to pick up Lars von Trier at the local airport in Hartford, Connecticut, which is like the nearest airport to where I grew up. And it was like a horrible snowstorm. And, you know, I had my parents' old station wagon and it wouldn't start, and like all the things that happened in a dream. And I forget how it even ended up, but somehow I missed him, or I got there and he was angry, or like, you know, everything didn't work out. And I had somehow missed this opportunity to spend time with this guy who, you know, when I was in high school was like a real, kind of an idol figure to me at that time. And the person I was telling it to said, oh, you know, no worries, because that would never happen because he doesn't fly.
Yeah, famously.
Which he certainly doesn't. But I think, you know, those films in the 90s, mid to late 90s, or actually, you know, throughout the 90s, do actually, in my opinion, have a holiness to them. You know, there's a kind of embodiment of what feels to me like a genuine Christianity, like a medieval Christianity of like a real illumination through suffering. Hmm. Right. So it's like Dancer in the Dark, Breaking the Waves, maybe those two most of all. And by the time he gets to Antichrist, which is still a good film, but he's become kind of a troll, or he's kind of, you know, he's like flicking people in the eye a little bit. But like some of those films in the 90s, Dogville too, I think, but like most of all, Breaking the Waves and Dancer in the Dark, there's just like really a yearning for deliverance from pain through pain. And maybe that, you know, from my like Jewish perspective, but my understanding of like the passion of Christ is that, right, is like you become holy or reveal that you are holy by suffering in a way that like no one could imagine ever suffering. And there's something real about Lars in that that is kind of sad to me that he's become. I mean, like the right wing stuff is what it is. Like if his films were still great, that would be kind of a footnote. But I feel like he's lost his faith. It feels to me that he doesn't believe in anything anymore. And maybe he would say that he never did. Like he would say that those 90s films were also an expression of his own nihilism, which he would be free to say. But I think if you watch the films, you wouldn't come away with that feeling.
I will be sure to go back and watch them. I always, when presented with the opportunity of watching more Lars von Trier films, tend to shy away.
They certainly don't scream out at a fun evening.
No, I'm pretty sure at some point while watching The House That Jack Built, my wife was just like, we're not doing this anymore. Turn the movie off and put something else on.
Yeah, because it's gratuitous, or it's a sense that it's like suffering without, not just without God, but without even like an aesthetic reason. It's just kind of like, feels like it's done, or almost like not only with having lost faith in any religious sense, but like even having lost faith in cinema. You know, and I think that's something that I was trying to get at with his cameo in Berlin Wall, that, you know, it's kind of a joke and there's some like disgusting aspects to it, but also that he was like driven by some desperation to set this like holy war in motion to reclaim a power that he had briefly had, almost like he was a kind of prophet who had squandered his gift and maybe then was afraid looking back that he had never been a prophet. And maybe he never thought he was, right? He was someone who was like accidentally a prophet for a minute, you know, or for a decade, but then stopped, you know, or someone who just lived too long in a certain way.
That kind of mirrors Annika a little bit then.
100%. Yeah. 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 That's interesting. Right. And I'm interested in people who aren't sure if what they have to offer is of genuine value. And like, there's a part of them that is almost afraid that they have a calling that is greater than themselves. And it's like so great that it's terrifying and that they wish they could refuse. The way like in almost every Messiah story, the Messiah at first refuses the calling, right? Like you never trust people who are too excited about being the Messiah, right? And you probably shouldn't trust them. But on the other hand, certainly with Annika, there's the opposite problem too, of maybe she's like outlived her own usefulness, even to herself, you know, and has become a kind of useful idiot or someone who's just going to be like wrapped up into the service of something else.
Yeah. I really like the scene where she's giving an interview and at the end of it, the interviewer is like, well, I hope wherever you think you are, you get to stay there.
Yeah.
Which in the book came off as genuine, like, you know, don't figure out what's really going on, because what you've got going on is way better, which is why in the context of the book, her stories are becoming so popular. But also I think that is such a fantastic insult to give somebody. And I look forward to having the opportunity to use it in some way, shape, or form, because,
And maybe it's even more insulting, or like it cuts deeper the more sincere it is. You know, that like you're not mocking that where they think they are isn't a real place. You know, you're not claiming that. You really are saying like almost, you know, I hope wherever you think you are, you stay there, and I hope it is a place. Right? Like maybe you got out or you ended up in a different realm that you should just stay in and don't try to communicate with us anymore.
Yeah.
Don't let us pull you back.
Yeah. Yeah. And then we haven't yet really talked about Uta, who is an interesting character, as the Berlin Wall is alive or was alive or is now was like one thing and is trying to come back. I found her story interesting kind of because it suggested a lot of things about the world. and wasn't quite as explicit as some of the other characters.
Yeah, right. I mean, she's sort of the counterpart to Georgi, and the two of them sort of end up on a journey together. You know, and each one of them is like an embodied piece of history, but in the opposite way. Right, that Georgi's, you know, this Hungarian teenager who feels cut off from Hungarian history. Like, he doesn't want to go back to communism, but is not very excited about whatever kind of like capitalism or, you know, quasi-liberalism exists there now. You know, and he's a kind of intellectual and he wants to benefit from coming west and, you know, studying in Germany and stuff. And it gets disillusioned by that as well. You know, but he's somebody who's like cut off from history and is so young that he fears there just won't be any history. He feels like he's in this kind of zombie present where like there's no past or future. And he's attracted to this like Atlantis cult in Norway because it promises, you know, a mythic past. It basically promises to annihilate the present and refound a mythic past that will then lead to a mythic future and therefore a kind of eternity. And Uta's the exact opposite, right? That she is a living piece of history, if you believe that she really was part of the wall, which she sometimes doesn't believe, but maybe she is. She's a living piece of history. And even if she wasn't really part of the wall, she's part of the culture of people who think she's part of the wall. So she's part of that history. And she wants to be free of it, right? She basically wants to find a way to like permanently die. She's like a kind of angel that just keeps coming back to Earth or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And she wants to just not be anyone else's symbol. Like, she's someone who's never, she's not exactly a person, I guess, but she's someone who's never been able to live for herself. Like, she always represents something to other people, you know, either something bad if you think the wall was a bad thing, or something good if you have this kind of nostalgia for the wall, which, you know, I think is a thing. Like, definitely that, I didn't make that up. But she never gets to just be herself, ironically, even though she's alone almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, to me, yeah, that was kind of a poignant character, and like someone who is very unlike me in every like outward sense, but who I somehow could relate to in the way I was thinking about her psychology.
Yeah. Yeah. That description of her, I feel a kinship there. An interesting, sort of side note. I don't know like where all of the pieces of the wall are in real life. But I do know, that there is one at my local public museum. And so like I grew up seeing the wall all the time, which is an interesting sort of thing because it's very present in my mind that way, right? Like, you don't, it's in the part of the museum you don't even have to pay to see. So like between the front desk and the gift shop is a piece of the Berlin Wall, and you can walk around it, right? Like, you can see the one side of it covered in graffiti and walk around to the other side and see like barely any, right? And you can see how tall it is and how thick it is. And like the building I work in is near it. Like, for most of my waking life, I'm never more than a mile away from the Berlin Wall. And wow. It's so it kind of made the book just like heavier for me, right? Like, I finished it up today sitting outside a block away from the Berlin Wall. And I don't know, there's lots of like so many modern day frustrations in the book, and I guess we were talking about that too with time loops and stuff, but yeah, I don't know where I was going with that.
Well, also, yeah, like the era when we grew up, or if it's like, you know, late 80s, 90s, early 2000s, you know, like Clinton and Bush era, but late Reagan, Clinton and Bush, you know, it's the post-wall era, right? And it's kind of this, it's like, you break it, you buy it kind of thing, right? It's like, we have all these pieces of the wall, you know, throughout America, I never went to look at it, but I think there's one at UMass near where I grew up also. And I think it, you know, who knows why all these different places collected them, but it feels like it's kind of triumphal, right? It's like, we won, we broke the wall, you know, fuck you guys. Like, you know, you can't like break up Europe anymore and everything, you know, and it's this triumphant thing. And Reagan's, you know, telling Gorbachev to knock it down and all that. But then there's the question of like, well, what now, right? It's like, you break it, you buy it, of like, what did we buy? You know, what is the world now that's not defined by that conflict? You know, and it's kind of, that's the question we grew up in, right? Which was kind of a golden age, I guess, right? I mean, there's something less deranged about the 90s in some ways, but then also, you know, we all grew up like obsessed with horror for some reason. And, you know, there was some kind of like dark undercurrent of like, what is the meaning of the world when it's not, you know, Superman versus a supervillain, right? When you're not telling yourself that story anymore, you don't have an evil empire. You know, and we tried to make a new evil empire after 9/11, but it's not the same, right? It's not literally like a territorial thing behind a wall in the same way, right? Like, yeah. That was the hyper clarity of that wall. You know, and I remember as a kid, probably a lot of kids in the 90s thought this. I pictured the wall both being insanely high, being like 1,000 feet high, you know, because I probably, you know, I was born in 86, so it fell in 89. I'm sure I didn't know anything about it then. But say I started hearing about it when I was like, you know, 5 or 6, so like in the early 90s. At the same time when I was getting really into medieval stuff, right? So I was really into castles and moats and turrets and all of that. And, you know, I had a like vivid imagination. So I remember picturing the Berlin Wall as this just insane like medieval bulwark that was, you know, 1,000 feet high and that literally divided the world in half. You know what I mean? That like went from the North Pole to the South Pole and was whatever that would be, you know, 10,000 miles long or something. And then to learn as a teenager, you know, maybe studying in like a textbook in high school or something, that it was really just like this little ring in Berlin and it was like, I don't know, 15 feet high. On the one hand, it was this huge disappointment. And I was like, wait a second, like my view of this kind of epic medieval battle was totally off. But then this kind of stranger question of like, well, why did people think it was so significant? Like, how could something so physically minor in the scheme of things still command such a large, you know, share of people's minds, or like something, it almost like it cast a much bigger shadow than something of that size could physically cast.
Yeah. And in a lot of ways is still casting that shadow for a lot of people.
Yeah, we're back in some crazy like territorial war with Russia. Like,
yeah.
Like, how is that still happening? You know, like it does feel like some Groundhog Day of like we're seriously talking about like fighting in the Russian border, like who's support, like that's literally, that seems like some 1940s that, you know.
Right. And the, you know, as far as dire world conflicts right now, the Gen Xers that I work with are like baffled that Russia-Ukraine is not at the forefront of everybody's mind all the time. They're like, you know, they're like, yeah, Israel-Palestine, you know, like, yeah, it's bad or whatever. But like, why are we not sending troops to Ukraine right now? And why haven't we been? Have we learned nothing? And that's... Right. That's so fascinating to me.
Yeah, right. Because it's probably their, like the heroism that they grew up with, right? Is like, you know, some kind of American power thwarting Russia at every turn, right? You know what I mean? Yeah, I recently read this book, Devil's Chessboard, which is like a history of Alan Dulles in the CIA and his, you know, being in, I think he was in Switzerland, like being in Europe throughout World War II, and then totally being just like the prototypical Cold Warrior and, you know, egging Eisenhower on to start up all these agencies. And, you know, I'm sure, I don't know what his relation to like the actual Berlin Wall is, but being totally enmeshed in that world at that time. And I sort of had the sense that it was like, you know, these guys, it sounds strange to say, but it was almost like World War II was too much fun for them. These guys just like couldn't give up after that. They couldn't like stop doing what they were doing, you know, like that was what forged their view of the world. I'm sure Russia was the same way, but it was like they just couldn't like put down their toys, you know, like there was nothing else for them to do. So it's like they were going to just keep it going in a new way as much as possible.
Right. Yeah, all these boomers can't understand computers, and so modern warfare is no fun. All, you know, espionage and hacking and drones and stuff is just like, it's not Age of Empires.
it's cold, right? It's kind of, you know, like bodies, you know, blowing up like are warm, right? I mean, there is a sense of like humans interacting with each other in some like primal way. And the more distant that get, you know, that's like a whole history of warfare. But, you know, you go from like rocks to knives to longer swords to guns to cannons to missile, you know, bombs, missiles, and now drones. You know, like there's some sense that people get further and further from actually encountering each other.
Yeah, I remember listening to a podcast at one point where somebody was talking about like, yeah, in 50 to 100 years, there's just going to be like a designated Colosseum where different nationalities send automated mech robots to fight each other. And that's just how conflicts are going to be decided.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, it's an interesting question. What war truly represents to people, and like, what is the thing that makes it not stop? You know, like, what are we getting out of continuing to do it on a truly emotional level? And would we be satisfied by seeing those robots fight or not? You know, is there something else that we're looking for in just like continually doing this throughout our entire history?
We'll be right back.